You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Hey, you, and welcome to Sex Gets Real. It's the first episode of 2020, and I am so glad you're here. I'm glad you're here because the world, as of my recording of this, is not doing well. It hasn't been doing well for a while. The fires in Australia continue to rage. The loss of life and the impact of future life is just catastrophic. Trump bombed Iran and potentially started another war. Protests and human rights tragedies are unfolding in nearly every corner of the globe, and our planet is literally dying beneath us and around us. And as things continue to shift and deteriorate, as we have these existential crises, I really do believe that being able to settle into our bodies and the relationships that keep us going is more important than ever. It's also more important than ever that we tend to each other with care and with grace, that we're able to offer and ask for support, to celebrate the small moments and all that pleasure that does heal. So thank you. I really mean that. Thank you as we start this new year in the middle of this apocalypse. Thank you for being willing to ask scary questions, to be inside of big, complicated spaces with me. It feels so nourishing. And I think nourishment, especially right now, feels really precious. So knowing that you are here listening and being a part of this, it means something. You know what else feels precious? Your emails. So many of you wrote in over the past couple of weeks with questions and areas where you could use support, and that means so much. And speaking of, if you could use some support or you want help unpacking a problem, write to me. I would love to hear from you. So you can go to dawnsarah.com and use the contact form there to shoot me a note. There's an anonymous option if you want to protect your identity, or if something you're sharing feels especially tender or personal. Hearing from you is the best, and I love it. And you'll hear some of your emails on today's episode. Also, patrons, if you support the show at $5 a month and above, you can help me answer listener questions. And there is a new listener question waiting at patreon.com/sgrpodcast. All about polyamory and jealousy. If you want to weigh in, share your thoughts or your stories, I would love to be able to share that on a future episode. In fact, you'll hear a patron weighing in on one of the questions that we've got today. And for folks who support at $3 per month and above, a new bonus is going up this week, and it's all about setting some intentions for 2020. What are some of the things we're ready to leave behind? What are some of the things we need to grieve? What are the ways that we can bring pleasure in on a daily basis? What would help us foster more space for the erotic, and much more? So if you would like to help me keep the show going, every single dollar matters, even if it's just a dollar that you're able to contribute. You can check out all of the options at patreon.com/sgrpodcast for Sex Gets Real. Okay, so before we get to your emails, there was an amazing thread by Twitter user Sean LaShawn, all about fat sex. And I just needed to share it here. I bookmarked it the moment that I saw it, shared it a whole bunch of places, and knew I was going to read this on the show. I am going to link to not only Sean LaShawn's thread, but Sean LaShawn also shared a number of really great articles about sex with fat folks. So I'm going to have all of those at dawnsarah.com/EP289 for episode 289, which is this show. So here's what Sean LaShawn wrote. I have sex with fat people, and it's not revolutionary. A thread. I'm super leery of non-fat people who frame sex with fat folks as an act of liberation. Similar to when they do it to trans folks, it always seemed very sensational to me. I'm often complimented or thanked about my profile language on the apps. All they say are that I'm trans, don't like white people, and I'm into HIV-positive folks, femmes, and all kinds of bodies. Nothing about this deserves to be complimented or thanked. I often think about the fat folks who sheepishly ask if I'm into chubby people before sending their nudes, and the fat folks who offer to keep their shirts on or turn the lights off as if they hoped the offer would persuade me to see them, and the fat folks who were shocked when I asked if I could feel them up during play or sexy times. FYI, I ask everyone this question, and you should too. And the fat folks who seem surprised when I wrap both my arms around them for hugs instead of doing that half-assed, one-armed hug thin people do when they're scared to touch fat people. And the fat folks who think they can't do rope bondage or suspension. Y'all can. It sometimes requires thicker rope for comfort and safety. And the fat folks who have joked about being too big for my small frame to handle and were speechless when I knew how to make things work, meaning not expecting their bodies to do the same things or move in the same ways as thin bodies. I've always thought it strange not to admit that people have sex differently. Maybe skinny bae can put their ankles next to their ears, but fat bae may not be able to. Ignoring that seems phobic to me in that I don't see race equivalent kind of way. It's okay to admit that there are tips and tricks to sex with fat folks. There are also tips and tricks to sex with trans folks, disabled folks, etc. Sex isn't one mode fits all. Our bodies are different, so our sex needs to be different too. Where I was going with this is that fat folks are hot and deserve so much better than crumbs many thin people offer, thinking that they're doing fat folks a favor. No one wants your pity fuck, thin fuck boy. Go away. I have sex with fat people because they're hot. Not because they're fat. Not in spite of them being fat. Not because it's more cushion for the pushin. Not because they wear it well. Not because thick thighs save lives. Not because they're big but healthy. Because they are hot. Folks keep trying to offer witty qualifiers about why fat people are attractive. Celebrate fat bodies without the backhanded compliments. Having sex with fat people isn't a political statement. I don't do it because I'm radical. I don't do it in the name of liberation. I do it because shorty is fine as fuck and I like butt touching. Nothing I'm saying is new, by the way. Fat folks have been talking about fat phobia in sex culture, queer politics, etc. And also, don't have sex with fat people as a way to overcome your fat phobia. It's fat phobic. Also, don't think that having fat friends, family, or partners means you're not fat phobic. You may be nice to them, I doubt it, but how do you treat fat folks you don't know? Also, there are lots of reasons and ways to drag people you don't like. Their fatness isn't one of them. Moral of the story, thin people need to be better. Small fat people need to fall back, and big fat people can do and wear what they want. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. Ah, Yes, 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 yes. Sean LaShawn, all of that. And so much of that really does apply to sex with disabled folks, sex with trans folks. There's a lot in this thread that just needed to be said and needs to be said over and over and over and over and over again. So please go check out that thread, share the heck out of it, and really sit with it. Your own fat phobia, your own stories about who is hot and who is not and why. I also came across two tweets by someone who uses the handle PengMelly, and I wanted to highlight those two. The first says, "We love good intentions and bad intentions, but no particular intentions for anyone but myself is where most shit goes down." This ties so heavily to all of the conversations we've been having lately about relational responsibility. No particular intentions or not intending something is not the same as taking care and being thoughtful. So often we're thinking only of ourselves and our desires and our needs and not of the impact that we're having on the people around us. And so much harm happens in that space. And I just want to add, for those of us who are caretakers, this applies too, though, in a kind of a slightly different angle. Folks who are socialized as female and folks who identify as a people pleaser often take great care to think about others, to the point sometimes of trying to control everyone and everything, to get things perfect, to prevent others from having their own messy experiences, and that can cause harm too. So there's a lot wrapped up in this tiny tweet, but as so many relationship handbooks and relationship guides kind of re-establish this hyper-individual narrative, I really want us to think about the fact that no particular intentions for anyone but myself is a place that's ripe for causing harm. And not meaning to, but still doing it. The other thing that PengMelly tweeted that struck me was this: "I don't understand this idea that transgressions should only have a temporary impact on the transgressor, even though they have a lifelong impact on the survivor. It defies physics. Why wouldn't we both feel the reverberations of what you did for the rest of our lives?" And I wanted us to sit with this a little bit. I think there's something really important here. And what I don't want this tied to is to punishment or to revenge or vengeance, but instead to something that's a lot more generative and healing for all of us. If you've sexually assaulted someone, the person you harmed has to live with that, potentially for life. Trauma changes us profoundly. We can never go back to who we were prior to that. And many people, like Resma Manickam, who wrote My Grandmother's Hands, now argue that to cause harm is also to experience trauma. But there's so little opportunity for us to hold each other accountable in ongoing, loving, boundaried ways, that it's really tough for us to imagine ways of being in relationship where the things we do don't define us as being good or bad, but they are folded into our story as a source of true change. And I want that for more of us, because this shifts the conversation away from being worried that someone who's caused harm will have their life ruined in some way. What if, when you harm someone, you are changed forever by it? And that change is held in all of its complexity by those around you, both to ensure you don't cause that kind of harm again and to hold you really firmly with love to do better for the rest of your life. I think that's a really big question, but I really just appreciated what PengMelly was saying around, "I don't understand this idea that transgressions should only have a temporary impact on the transgressor, even though they have a lifelong impact on the survivor." why wouldn't we both feel the reverberations of what you did for the rest of our lives? So there's a lot to hold and chew on around that, to be sure. Things that were just making my brain spin and my body say yes. So let's jump into your emails because there's some really, really important ones this week. So if you're ready, let's jump in. This first email from Lee is about a sexless relationship. Lee writes, "Hi Dawn, first off, I should tell you, I've listened to literally every episode of Sex Gets Real. I really love the direction you've taken the show, and I've recommended it to many people who are seeking a gentle, sensible, and compassionate approach. If I lived in Vancouver, I would probably just have booked a session with you to talk about this issue. I've been with my partner for a year, living together for 6 months. I'm a cis woman, he's a cis man. Basically, the issue that's haunting me is the sex has just stopped. When we got together, we had sex regularly. It was pretty vanilla by my standards, but satisfying. Since moving in together, the sex has really dropped off to never. I have no idea how to address this with my partner, which is weird because I'm not at all shy and usually not about sexual issues. I think this issue really pushes my buttons because it taps into a fear I have of the relationship failing due to this issue. My partner doesn't seem to have a problem with the lack of sex. On the rare occasion that we go out of town, generally we will have sex, often daily or every couple of days. I should add we live in close proximity to his parents, which I guess might be an inhibiting factor for him. I'm just weirdly paralyzed about talking to him about it. It's like I feel that if I acknowledge this one issue, I'm opening a can of worms or squeezing toothpaste out of a tube and won't be able to get it back in. He doesn't seem concerned at all about this. I've masturbated from time to time, but frankly, the lack of sex has impacted my libido. I worry that we've fast-tracked into a sibling relationship after only a year of dating. Additionally, when we did have sex more often, it was very vanilla. So my questions are, one, how do I broach this subject with my partner? We communicate easily about most other issues. Two, how do I avoid catastrophizing that this is the death knell of my happy relationship? I love this man and don't want this partnership to end, certainly not over this issue. And three, how do you stack complaints? Like, we aren't having sex, but when we do, it's boring? That sounds terrible. I hope you might have something to share. I do appreciate your work tremendously. Thanks so much for taking the time to read this long note. XO Lee." Ah, well, hello to you, Lee. Thank you so much for listening to the show and for so long to boot. And also thanks for sharing the show with your friends and for writing in. I'm sure you know you are not alone in this question at all. I promise there are many people listening to this right now who are feeling like they could have written this email. So the first thing I want to say is I know you said if you lived in Vancouver, you would have booked a coaching session with me. And it is true. I see in-person clients at this really pretty little office that's right downtown. And the majority of my clients are from other places. I've got clients in Australia, Germany, California, all up and down the East Coast of the US and Canada, because the majority of my coaching is actually virtual via video conferencing. So just a note to you, Lee, and everyone else listening, if you could use some professional support, if you'd like some coaching, either individual or couples, or I've had triads as well, you can be from anywhere in the world. And details about coaching are all at dawnsarah.com. So check that out if you're interested. I did share this question on Patreon for $5 supporters, and Jason weighed in with the following. "My wife and I have had similar issues in the past, and sometimes with work, etc., this isn't possible, but when it feels like we're getting into a distant point, we actually make an appointment with each other. We turn off the devices and turn on each other. Even if it isn't to have sex, just to be together and be close. So thank you so much for that, Jason. I love the idea of making an appointment with each other to turn each other on without the expectation or the pressure of sex. And that you acknowledge sometimes life just gets really lifey and even the appointments can't happen. A big yes to all of that. All of that is true. That is a part of what it means to live these really busy lives, these stressful lives, these overwhelming lives, and juggling so many different things while trying to nurture the relationships that we're in. For your questions, Lee, I'd love to start with the second question. How do I avoid catastrophizing that this is the death knell of my happy relationship? I think one of the fictions that so many of us have internalized because of the happily ever after narratives that are really common in all of the stories we consume from the earliest ages is that things, once we fall in love with someone, are going to more or less stay the same, and that that's what happiness looks like. And of course, intellectually, we know that that's not true, but deeper in our bodies, way down inside, because we've been getting these messages literally from birth for some of us, we can begin constricting with fear when we notice things are a little different. And then that constriction can cause us to start like scanning for certain behaviors, which causes us to notice those things more often, which then leads us to being more focused on this one thing because we're becoming afraid of it. We don't know at what point we should say something, and it becomes this really ugly spiral that can take a pretty manageable and normal ebb and flow or problem and make them seem enormous and catastrophic and devastating. I speak from personal experience. I'm very good at this particular spiral, and I've done it many times in a relationship. And so a big part of what I have to do is to just continually bring myself back to all of the reasons that I am in relationship with these people or this particular person, and to remind myself that even if this one area is feeling painful, if I'm still feeling really nourished and supported in all these other areas, to make sure I'm devoting a lot of attention to those things that are feeling really good so that I don't get overtaken. But it's a practice and it's a hard one. Sometimes I go quite far down on that spiral before I catch myself. When any relationship, and I'm talking sexual, platonic, professional, neighborly, familial, any relationship that lasts long enough moves through cycles and seasons, ebbs and flows, ups and downs. And some of those seasons are for a specific reason. Maybe somebody has an illness or has a family member who's dying. Maybe somebody's in grad school and working really long, arduous hours on their papers. And other cycles and seasons are simply because of circumstances we're in. Our bodies are changing, we're aging, the world around us is a very, very stressful, apocalyptic place. And that also has an impact on the ways that we are in our relationships. So for you, Lee, I wonder what that part of you that wants to catastrophize this is trying to protect you from. If you were to give that inner part of you that's worrying and hyper-focused on the lack of sex a microphone, what would that part say? It could be anything. Maybe I knew it. I knew this would happen. This is exactly what I was afraid of. See, I knew this wouldn't work. Or maybe that part of you is saying, nope, I cannot deal with this. If this is how it's going to be, we need to get out now because I just can't deal with being heartbroken and I need to beat the heartbreak. Either way, whatever it is that part of you that really wants to catastrophize the current situation, that part is really trying to protect you from something. It might be trying to protect you from feeling abandoned or undesirable or bored. So asking, what are you trying to protect me from, can be a really compassionate way to start understanding more about your own fears and then to invite collaboration with that inner part to find more supportive ways to move forward. Maybe that inner part wants to catastrophize because it's trying to prevent you from getting hurt. And if you can actually help it to feel heard and like, I know you're trying to protect me. Thank you for working so hard. How can we do this differently? That's an old story that's not true anymore. And to really turn towards the that inner part of you that wants to do that with love, you might find some really interesting things. Because when we reject or ignore or shut down those inner parts because they're mean and uncomfortable, usually they just get louder and meaner and more insistent. And then it becomes really difficult to deal with them. I also think it can help to just sit down with yourself and to consider what sex means to you. Like, why is sex important? What needs does it meet? It might be a combination of things like touch needs and feeling close to your partner. Maybe pleasure is a part of it. Maybe it feels a little bit adventurous and you really like that. Knowing what's underneath that can help you work with your partner to find all sorts of yummy ways to get more of those needs met when you finally do talk to him. And that can also help to give you a sense of clarity and help you to shift away from fear and doom and gloom towards hope and possibility. And working with a professional, whether it's me or a therapist near you or something else, can be really helpful around stuff like this so that you have a place to give voice to some of these stories and to get curious with them without kind of unloading them on your partner. So I would encourage you to just ask some of those questions, to maybe try to befriend the part of you that is feeling terrified and to see what is it trying to protect you from and how maybe can you do things a little bit differently. Okay, so let's talk about your first question. The final question you asked was, how do you stack complaints? I think the answer is, if this is someone you care about and you really want to maintain a relationship with, then you don't. You don't stack complaints. I wouldn't, but we all get to do relationship differently. I don't want to be in relationship in a way where the people I care about feel like I'm loading all of my complaints on them and just holding on to things when they bother me. You know, that would probably move me further away from what I want, which is connection and trust and curiosity and transparency and creativity and joy. And you might want different things, and that's super okay. There's no judgment. We all get to be in relationship in the ways we want to be in relationship. But I think what's helpful is, instead of saying, here's all the things that are wrong, instead asking, how can I really approach this from a place of deep curiosity, hope, and desire? My guess is he's feeling self-conscious about the sexual situation. He's probably picking up on your kind of simmering fear and disappointment, and that's probably closing him down. When we're in relationship with other people, we start to become pretty adept at what's not being said. We start picking up on those micro cues, those micro movements of facial muscles, of the things that go unspoken. And we can really spin ourselves into some dark places because of the things that aren't being said. So instead of stacking complaints, I think it's helpful to ask, what is it you want? What is the most important thing, and what's a nice to have? What are the skills and the tools that would help you both get to a place of more connection and open communication? What are small experiments and changes you could try that would help to slowly and realistically start moving you both in that direction? My guess is it's not listing all of the things that aren't working and that he's doing wrong. That's not going to move you in that direction. So really thinking about the things you want versus the things that are broken. And I think that brings us to your first question, which is, how do I broach this subject with my partner? And my answer to that is with grace, with compassion, with truly open curiosity. His inner experience might really surprise you. But most of us won't share the things we are afraid of or that we're secretly thinking about if we feel like we're going to be judged or if we feel like the other person has an agenda that requires us to be different. You said you communicate pretty easily about most things, but not sex. And I think that that's really fantastic. It means you have a really solid foundation to start from. So what if you started by just admitting to him you've realized talking about sex feels kind of awkward and weird? And is he feeling that way too? And to share that you'd really love for the two of you to find some fun ways to talk about sex so that it felt kind of freeing and playful. And bringing in that play can be such a rejuvenating energy when you are dealing with other people. Maybe get my sex maps game so the two of you have this huge collection of really fun, low stakes questions so that you can practice asking each other about sex. Things like, what did you fantasize about when you were a teenager? Or what's one movie scene that always turns you on? Building the muscles of being able to talk really openly about sexual experiences without it being about this kind of tender present moment where you really need things to change means that when you do finally start talking about your current situation, you have all these positive experiences and memories to lay the foundation. And that's one of the reasons why I want all of us, regardless of how long we've been in relationship, to start developing the skills of being able to talk about the things that turn us on, to talk about masturbation, to talk about the fantasies that we have, the movie scenes that turn us on, the kind of porn that we watched when you were younger. All of those things help us to build these positive experiences and memories that help us to feel connected around our conversations around sex. If we only ever talk about sex when something's not working, that's going to create an awful lot of pain and fear and make people really not want to talk about sex, which is the opposite of what we want. Because if we can talk about it, then it means we can so much easier ask for new things and say, hey, this didn't feel quite right. Maybe we can try this other thing the next time. And it doesn't feel like a judgment or a critique because we don't have a long history of judgments and critiques. I hope that makes sense. And also it might be helpful to read some books together. I know a lot of couples who will get a book about something that they want to strengthen or learn, and then they'll take turns reading to each other and do like a chapter a week or those kinds of things. And even reading on your own. I think Esther Perel's Mating in Captivity might be a really great place to start. In that book, she talks about how erotic energy really thrives on mystery and the unknown. And often when we spend a lot of time together or we cohabitate, we can move too far along the intimacy and erotic spectrum into that safety, familiarity, intimacy place, which kind of smothers that heat and that flame of the erotic. So she talks about finding ways to introduce some mystery, some surprise, some anticipation, and the unknown. And how that can help facilitate more heat. I think it's so easy for us to feel like we're the ones who are more worried, more afraid, more stressed, more in pain, because we live in our heads. And our heads really want to make us the most important person in the universe. It's also the only experience we know. But that can then start to create a story that the other people in our lives don't care as much, aren't as impacted. We forget that they also have super complex, messy, deep inner experiences. And if there's shame mixed in, they might go to great lengths to hide that because shame's primary purpose is to stay in the dark. So my question for you, Lee, is how can you get curious about his experience? What's he been feeling since you moved in together? Is he terrified that his parents might be stopping by at some point? What does desire feel like for him? What are his wants? What would feel supportive right now? What would he love to have happen down the road? Is he happy not having sex right now? And if so, what are other ways he'd love to connect intimately? If he's not happy about it, then what are some ways that the two of you can practice new things? Is he going through something stressful that's impacted his erections maybe, and he's ashamed to admit that, so avoiding sex feels easier than admitting something about his body? What kinds of adventures or fun does he hope for the future for the two of you? What about your daily lives would feel good to shake up or what would he love to try with you? And he hasn't known how to ask. The only way to know is to talk to him with genuine, caring curiosity. And I know that you feel kind of stuck around this, and this is sometimes one of those things where you just kind of have to take the leap and find out that it's not going to be the worst thing in the whole wide world, and then do it again and do it again. Remember, you love this person and he loves you. And you two have this really awesome opportunity to start connecting in new and deeper ways around this question that you're holding. And that alone really does feel so exciting. What could be around the corner? Where might you go together? There are two of you, which means there's so many opportunities for trying things and getting creative and collaborating. You might end up in a very different place than where you started. And you also might realize that this just isn't a good fit for you. Or you might find out he's been obsessing over the very same things. And a few conversations is all that it takes to shift things so that you start sharing that a little more openly. But you can't know that until you start having those conversations. And the longer you put it off, the bigger that fear and anxiety becomes. It can feel so hard and so awkward. And we just have to remind ourselves that it's worth it. We are worth it. Love is worth it. This connection is worth it to take the leap, because that's just what it means to be in a relationship with someone. So I hope that offers you some things to think about and to play with, Lee. There's so many amazing questions, so many places you might end up, so many things to even just ask yourself before you even start talking to your partner. And if you do want coaching, feel free to reach out. I would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for reaching out. I know that this is a very common place to be, and lots of people listening are in a similar kind of quandary. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to be in it with you. This next email talks about being raped. It's not explicit in the details of what happened, but it does speak of rape and the hard feelings that come with it. So please take care of you. If you're listening and that's not something that you feel like you've got the capacity for right now, then feel free to jump ahead to the next question. So Emma wrote in a heartbreaking email, and it reads, "It's 1:49 a.m. and I have been crying nonstop since about 8 p.m. today. I'm currently taking a break from work and I have a lot of time to think while alone. I also have time to spend with loved ones. And today, during my alone time and during my time with loved ones, I thought about the man who raped me. He was my best friend. He had raped me once before, but I didn't call it rape because I knew that we'd have to work through stuff I wasn't ready to work through. I had already been raped once before, and that by itself came with consequences. When he raped me again, which he does not remember, I was in absolute shock. I couldn't believe it was happening again. The next morning, I immediately bought Plan B and continued on with life. The first few months, I dove into work and didn't think too much about it until around this time last year. That's when I really started processing things because of taking that break from work. So essentially, I spent this entire year coming to terms with the fact that I lost my best friend, with whom I was in love and had a very, very strong connection, and was left to pick up the pieces on my own. Today, the thought of him came up randomly, and it's filling me with pain. He's been apologizing for the entire year. I've been trying to date, and I just keep running into unavailable men. It's frustrating. I feel unlovable and like something is wrong with me. I recognize these are my insecurities, but they just feel heavier knowing I lost a best friend. And I have to deal with these feelings of shame, guilt, disgust. It's a lot. Oh, Amma, I'm so, 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 so sorry you're here. I'm sorry you were raped not once, but multiple times. I'm sorry you lost your best friend. I'm sorry you feel so alone. It is frustrating. It is painful. It's a terrible burden that I wish none of us knew, but sadly, so, so many of us do. And it is a lot. It is. It's a lot. Sometimes it's too much for one person to carry on their own. So the first thing I just want to offer is that you deserve support. I don't know where in the world you are, but many places have free rape crisis hotlines where you can call and speak to a counselor. And they can be such a lifeline for people going through the aftermath of sexual assault and rape. Therapy, especially trauma-informed therapy, would probably be tremendously helpful, especially if you find a fantastic feminist therapist, if you have the means to access it. Even online therapeutic apps like Talkspace, where you text back and forth with a therapist, could be helpful, and those tend to be a little less expensive. And often there are local support groups too for sexual violence that are free or really low cost. And I just cannot stress how important it is to get support from people who have been in a similar place to you. There is so, so much healing that becomes available to us when we hear our stories echoed in the mouths of those around us. When we hear their shame and their guilt and their disgust, and when we feel that compassion and empathy come up, something really important happens there when we feel into the depths of that support that groups like that can offer. It's where I started doing so much of my healing, and it was really scary at first. It was so, so scary because, again, shame wants us to be isolated, to be alone. To feel like it's our fault. But being in a support group really ended up being incredibly important for me and so many others. So if you can find something like that, either online and or in person, it might help with some of the pain. Sometimes when we hurt this much, we become desperate to find people to cling to so that we don't feel so adrift. And that's normal and it makes sense. Of course, we would do that. It can also mean that we put ourselves into situations that don't serve us or the other people because we're so deep in our trauma. Dating right now, it's worth asking, is that the best place for you? Or are there other places where maybe you could do some more healing and support? And I also wonder where are there points of light amid the pain and the darkness? Are there friends in your life that you enjoy being with or who make things feel a little less heavy? Are there animals in your life that bring you touch and intimacy that feels safe, who bring silliness and playfulness? Are there places you love going that help you to feel just a little bit more at ease, where you can breathe? Making as many spaces as we can where we have those little soft moments is also so important to healing. And sometimes survival means hurrying and rushing and pretending we're okay and being anywhere but here. And that is a wise and important survival mechanism. Sometimes that's literally how we survive, is to just keep moving and numbing and avoiding. And if that's where you are right now, Amma, that's okay. You're not doing anything wrong. And sometimes finding those places and those people and the activities that give us a little bit of relief, that offer us some hope, that invite us to slow down for just a little bit so that we can start feeling, can be so crucial for us as we begin to heal. Healing work is deeply painful work. And that's why it's so important we have support. And while you might not be in a place to really take this in, at some point you will be. So just remember that. If you can't take what I'm about to say deep into you, at some point you will be able to do that. So keep this and remember it. You are not unlovable. You are deeply worthy and deserving of love and happiness, tenderness, safety, healing, passion, pleasure. You are deeply worthy and deserving. You are not unlovable, and you did not deserve what happened to you, no matter what. You did not deserve what happened to you, no matter what. It's okay to not forgive him. You can heal and not forgive. It's okay to cut him off. And it's okay to feel heartbroken by the loss of your best friend at the very same time. It's okay to not date for a while and to focus on healing, to building friendships and safe places. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to feel lost, because even when you feel lost and you're in pain and you don't know which way is up, you are still lovable and worthy and important. There is never any excuse for someone disrespecting you or using you the way that he did. You are lovable and worthy and important. I hope that you're able to access some support services, Amma. If you write back to me and tell me where in the world you are, I can try and use my networks to find some resources that are local to you, because no one should ever have to shoulder this kind of hurt alone. And healing really does become a lot more possible when we have support and care from others. You will get through this. It might hurt really bad for a long time. It might change you in ways that need to be grieved, but you will love again and you will be loved. And you are absolutely deserving of wonderful, pleasurable things and people who honor and validate you. Thank you so much for trusting me with this. And I'm sending so much love and solidarity. H wrote in about non-binary gender identity and pregnancy. So here's what they wrote. Hey, Dawn, I'm a non-binary masculine human being from the UK, early 30s, married to a cis woman. I have always wanted to be pregnant and have a baby, but also I have never wanted to be in my female body. I know it doesn't make sense. Recently, I embarked on the journey of IUI, so far unsuccessful, and I'm finding it incredibly difficult to navigate. This process has brought up a lot of internalized homophobia I didn't even know I had, and hatred of my masculine self. I don't understand where these feelings are coming from. At first, I thought it was just anger at the fact that we have to pay to have fertility treatment, whereas for hetero couples, it's free. It feels so unfair, but I always knew that fact, and my wife and I spent 3 years saving up a baby budget. I'm just finding it so hard to navigate my feelings toward myself and wondering if this means I shouldn't even be trying to get pregnant. I don't know how I'm meant to feel. When I try and find other people in similar circumstances, I can only find people who have been through it but now have the baby bliss end result. They're usually cis females, and the struggle was only the hardship of trying to get pregnant. How do I navigate gender and baby making and queerness? I am so very lost. H. H, thank you so much for trusting me with this. These are huge, important questions you're asking. And yeah, this space can be so messy and so hetero and cis normative. Bodies are weird. Like,
let's just be upfront. Bodies are real weird. Gender is super complicated. Making a new human, that's a bizarre and magical thing that's steeped in all kinds of stories and expectations. And you're in the thick of that swirling and confusing vortex. I think it makes perfect sense that you've wanted to be pregnant and have a baby at the same time as having really complicated feelings about your body. And you are literally in the middle of a great big thick soup that attaches a lot of meaning and stories to certain shapes and body parts. Of course that's complicated. So I reached out to my colleagues and got a whole bunch of really interesting things to share with you. And I hope that it gives you a jumping off point. So first up, Chris Maxwell Rose from The Pleasure Mechanics, who you've heard on the show a few times, has a friend who created this awesome podcast that I didn't know about, but now I do, and I'm so excited to, called Masculine Birth Ritual. The description for the podcast reads, "The things masculine of center, queer, and trans people do to make, birth, and nurture human life." How cool is that? That's like right up your alley. There's 16 episodes so far, and I'm going to link to the podcast at dawnsarah.com/EP289, plus all the stuff I'm about to mention, so you can check that out. And I'm really excited to know about this podcast, so I hope you check that out. You mentioned also knowing a few folks who have navigated this space of fertility treatments and pregnancy, but as you said, a lot of them are in the post-baby bliss stage. It might be really helpful to connect with people like Tristan Reese, who made their trans pregnancy very public and shared their journey on Instagram and through lots of interviews. And I wonder, there are lots of people like Tristan Reese who are trans and non-binary, who have been very public about their pregnancy journeys. Would it be helpful for you to go back to their pre-birth posts and to be in the questions they were asking and in the confusion of their past selves? That's actually one of the gifts of the internet. We can time travel in a way. You know, I mean, Tristan may now be a parent, but there were so many posts and articles that came out when they were pregnant. And there might be some solidarity and support to be found in those older resources that for you are very present. I'm also wondering, do you have access to a really rad midwife or doula? There are some queer doulas and midwives doing really, really important work with non-binary and trans and queer families. Refuge Midwifery is one that I highly recommend. They're very queer, non-binary, and trans inclusive, and do workshops and really cool things. So reaching out to them might be cool. There's also Jenna at Love Over Fear Wellness and Birth. Love Over Fear Wellness and Birth specializes in like trans and non-binary pregnancy and birth. And then there's also Tynan Rhea, who is not only a doula, but a non-binary badass who trains other doulas and midwives in serving non-binary and trans folks around pregnancy. So my question to you is there someone like that near you? Or could you maybe work with some of these folks that I mentioned online to feel more supported? I think everyone that I just mentioned is in the United States, but they have websites and post all kinds of cool resources on their social media and on their blogs. So that might be a way to just feel less alone. And they might know all kinds of resources that I don't. So even reaching out to them. I also did a quick search and found a midwife who's a trans man that's located in the UK named Nathan Daniel Welch. And there's a really fun article with him talking about midwifery and gender. So that also might be someone. Maybe Nathan knows some support groups and services near you. I think that being able to start following these people, even specifically reaching out and asking them if they know of anyone in your area, could probably yield some great results. I also found some articles by non-binary folks who are either wanting to get pregnant or are in the process of being pregnant, and they link to all sorts of groups and resources. So I'm going to link to those articles again at dawnsarah.com/EP289 so that you can check them out and hopefully find some good stuff. The last question that I have is, what about finding a support group for non-binary and trans folks who are trying to become pregnant? There might not be an in-person group near you. Like, I know in DC there was Rainbow Families, and they did all kinds of really cool pre-parenting workshops for queer, trans, and non-binary folks. So if there's not something like that near you, maybe like a Facebook group or a parenting forum, finding something like that where you can actually talk to other people who are in similar stages and or who are just a little ahead of where you are in these processes, who can kind of share the ways they've unpacked and held some of these questions. Because, I mean, I think the bottom line is it's clear you're not alone. Even if it really feels isolating right now, there are some awesome people who have been exactly where you are and who have documented their experiences online so that for those who come after them, they have resources and hope. And there's also some really, really, really great inclusive professionals who would probably love to support you or to share resources with you so that you can find support near you as you navigate this space. And it's also worth mentioning, if it just feels too complicated right now, you don't have to get pregnant. You can circle back down the road. It might cost a little bit more money and it might feel challenging to admit that, but you don't have to be ready right now. That's okay. Noticing what's coming up for you is important. And once you're pregnant, things are going to change really fast in a bunch of super unpredictable ways. Because again, bodies, pregnant bodies, they do weird things. So what would it feel like for you if you had more support in this time leading up to the pregnancy? Would it feel good to maybe have a therapist or to have a really great doula and midwife, to have a whole bunch of people you follow on social media who get it, to be a part of a support group, or even taking the time now to start cultivating and curating a care team that's really queer informed and who gets all of this stuff around the complexities of being non-binary and dealing with the world of prenatal and postnatal? Would that feel more empowering? Would you feel more supported? Things might not ever be simple or feel resolved, but I wonder if feeling less alone and having access to more resources might give you a sense of being less lost. Because I really want that for you. You are not alone in asking these questions and navigating this space. I think sometimes it's just hard to find those first couple of threads, and then whole new worlds start revealing themselves to you. I hope that was helpful for you, H. I am wishing you the very, very best from across the pond, and please keep us posted on your pregnancy journey. To all of you, that is it for this week's episode. Patrons, don't forget to head to patreon.com/sgrpodcast to get this week's bonus, all of our New Year's reflecting and dreaming. I will be back next week. And in the meantime, be sure to send in your questions. DawnSarah.com is where you can find me. I will talk to you soon. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue, treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the Vocal Few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
So don't be ashamed.